I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, optimism about the Mideast peace process, skepticism about chemical weapons allegations in Syria. Egypt's security breakdown leads to mob justice.
You see a weakening of the role of the states. This opens the door to vigilantism moving forward, and that's not a healthy environment in which to protect rights ultimately.
And a warning that water supplies are at risk from multiple threats. It's all ahead. U.S. President Barack Obama today is in Jordan as he continues his Middle East trip. His arrival was delayed due to a sandstorm that engulfed the region during the morning. Once he got on the ground at Queen Aliyah International Airport in Amman, however, the president was given a red carpet welcome. Discussions with Jordanian officials are expected to focus on Syrian refugees in Jordan, Jordan's economic reforms, bilateral ties, and the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. President Obama has just wrapped up a visit to Israel and the West Bank that included talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders and calls for the two sides to resume peace efforts. Thursday, in a speech at a university in Jerusalem, Mr. Obama assured his audience of young Israelis that they are not alone in facing threats to Israel's security. VOA senior White House correspondent Dan Robinson is traveling with the president.
Punctuated by frequent applause and at one point interrupted by a heckler, the speech was aimed at prompting Israel's younger generation to consider their future in an increasingly unstable region. Mr. Obama suggested that future must include risk-taking to achieve lasting peace with an independent and viable Palestinian state living alongside a secure Israel.
I believe that peace is the only path to true security. You have the opportunity to be the generation that permanently secures the Zionist dream, or you can face a growing challenge to its future.
Mr. Obama said it would be easier for him to offer unconditional support for Israel. Instead, he offered his advice as a friend deeply concerned about and committed to Israel's future. He said Israel faces sweeping political changes in the Arab world and changing demographics in the Middle East. By committing to a lasting peace with Palestinians, Israelis could reverse an undertow of isolation and blunt the impact of extremists.
No single step can change overnight what lies in the hearts and minds of millions. No single step is going to erase years of history and propaganda. But progress with the Palestinians is a powerful way to begin, while sidelining extremists who thrive on conflict and thrive on division. It would make a difference.
Mr. Obama added that Israel's security must be central to any settlement, and Israel will always have the support of the United States. Earlier in the occupied West Bank, Mr. Obama met with President Mahmoud Abbas. He urged Palestinians and Israelis not to remain frozen by old positions blocking direct negotiations. President Abbas called Israeli settlement policy the major hurdle to a two-state solution. Dan Robinson, VOA News, with President Obama.
Jason Isaacson is the Director of Government and International Affairs for the American Jewish Committee. We asked for his reaction to President Obama's trip to the Middle East.
Well, he sent a powerful message to the people of Israel, also to the Palestinian people. Today he's in Jordan, speaking with the Jordanian leadership as well. But the message to Israel was that America stands beside Israel. America has Israel's back. America understands, and he personally understands, the strategic threats facing Israel. Also urges Israel to move forward on efforts to make peace with the Palestinians, but in full cognizance of the dangers that Israel has faced and continues to face from Iran, from instability and, in fact, civil war and horror story that's unfolding in Syria, from instability across the Middle East, but that his view as a friend of Israel, as a supporter of Israel, is that Israel needs to find a way to work out a peaceful resolution to the conflict with the Palestinians, and that Palestinians have to come back to the bargaining table. He understands their situation. He understands their plight. He understands that they deserve a state, as does Israel's leadership, but that the only way that's going to be achieved is at the bargaining table. He wants the two sides to get together.
And he said that Israel and the Palestinians should set aside their differences for right now so that they can just reach that negotiating table. Do you think that's possible for Israel and the Palestinians to stop a moment and just talk and then make decisions?
It's going to be very difficult. And the president was quite clear-eyed in saying that it's going to be difficult. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. And we're probably not going to get an agreement in the very near future. But what we can begin to get is the establishment of some kind of trust, the establishment of some kind of confidence that the other side really does want to make peace. On the part of the Israelis, confidence that the Palestinian leadership is not intent on simply trotting around the globe and securing agreements to recognize the state of Palestine that are completely divorced from the reality of the fact that there is no currently state of Palestine. There can be, and there should be, a state of Palestine, but it must be achieved at the bargaining table. So I think yes, it is possible. It's not going to be easy. Maybe it'll be incremental steps to establish trust, to build confidence, to find ways to not provoke the other, but to start finding a path back to the bargaining table.
There had been concern before that there were some bad feelings between Israelis, especially Mr. Netanyahu and Barack Obama. Do you think this trip has healed all those wounds and we can go ahead?
Well, I think that the series of very powerful messages that the president was sending in repeated visits, repeated speeches in every possible kind of setting, demonstrating his recognition, his honoring of the history of Israel, the connection of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, his recognition of the threats that Israel has faced, his visit to the Iron Dome missile installation, his demonstration again and again of the rightness of Israel, the justification for Israel, the fact that Israel needs to have normal relations with all of its neighbors, and that Israel continues to face threats, but that Israel is strong. Israel is a close friend of the United States. This was not just about an affirmation of the military-to-military relationship, but really the cultural relationship, the emotional bond, the moral bond, the fact that there is a sharing of values between the United States and Israel. He was so clear in so many settings in his trip to Israel.
Well, as a representative of the American Jewish Committee, what is your feeling about the president's trip to Ramallah for talks with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and the Prime Minister Salam Fayyad?
I think it was very important. I think it was important for the president to recognize the institution building that has taken place in recent years, the fact that there really has been very important security cooperation between the Palestinians and the Israelis, that he understands that the people of the Palestinian territories deserve a state. There ought to be a Palestinian state living side by side in peace and security with Israel. He has said that before. Previous presidents have said that before. Saying it in Ramallah was significant. The fact that he was able to identify with that national movement of the Palestinians was important. At the same time, saying that the only way they will secure their hope, to fulfill their dream of a state, is at the bargaining table, setting aside preconditions, not trying to solve the issues before they sit down at the table, but in fact sitting down at the table to solve those issues. I think he was very clear in his affirmation of America's support for Palestinian statehood, but also America's determination to work with the Palestinians and the Israelis to achieve that state, but his statehood at the bargaining table in bilateral talks.
So you think that this trip has brought some optimism back to the peace process?
I think it has. Look, we've been in this peace process for two decades now, and there have been ups and downs, but frankly, far more downs. I think that this perhaps presages an effort to encourage the parties to bring hope to the peoples on both sides. I think it's possible to move forward, and the president has certainly expressed his determination to put America in the position of working with both parties to move forward.
Jason Isaacson with the American Jewish Committee. As we reported Thursday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is ordering an investigation into allegations of chemical weapons use in Syria. Mr. Ban is calling on all parties in Syria to grant full access and cooperation to the investigators. Rebels and the Syrian government accused each other of using chemical weapons during an attack near the hotly contested town of Aleppo. U.S. President Barack Obama said he is deeply skeptical of the claim that rebels used chemical weapons. He said Washington will carry out its own investigation. Amram Nagurzian is a senior fellow and Middle East expert with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Now, with this latest allegation made by the regime and a counter-allegation by elements of the opposition that chemical weapons were used, you're seeing a great deal of skepticism and reluctance. You're seeing a U.S. that has used strong rhetoric during the Obama trip, but at the same time a guarded rhetoric. They haven't push the narrative in terms of U.S. red lines on the use of CW chemical weapons holdings very far. I think that reflects the reality that you have a lot of questions on intelligence, actionable intelligence, in terms of assets on the ground, in terms of electronic surveillance, whether it's the U.S.'s, the Israelis, or Jordanians, or Turks. There are questions about what really is going on, and you see a general aversion to going very far with this story quickly. So the UN injecting itself with an inquiry, I think, is an exercise in cool heads prevailing. Now, is this the anomaly? Is this the pattern in Syria? It depends. I mean, the Assad regime clearly is trying to score points with this story. They're not going very, very far. They also have support from countries like Russia and China. Russia has welcomed the inquiry. The fact that the U.S. hasn't gone very far or farther than the pale in terms of accusing one side or the other is also a testament to a desire to maybe step back and see where are the metrics on this particular story. Where does reality really fall?
However, Nurgusian says he is supportive of a U.N. investigation of the chemical weapons allegations.
Most of the allegations we've seen over the last few months, stories that have potential use involved, are usually surrounding agents that are not top-tier chemical weapon systems. We're not talking about agents that have mass casualties, neuroparalytics and things like that, things that have very limited, potentially deadly, but limited utility in combat. None of this is verified. None of this is based on actionable intelligence. We're still 6 months, 7 months on since you started hearing these rumors in the realm of speculation. You've had a lot of skepticism about this story, and by that I mean in both directions. Countries like the U.S. have not rushed to criticize too much the opposition or too much the regime. You have this general standoffishness about the whole story. At worst, the UN will be neither able to confirm nor deny, and in that sense it would diffuse the tension, well, on this one story at least. At worst, you will have verification, but verification that it was used is one thing. Knowing exactly how, by whom, what quantity, we're speculating about that right now. Look, the best thing that can happen to the Syrian people is that this never happened. Hopefully it isn't what a lot of folks suspect it is, which is a use of a CW system. But I do think the fact that you have the role of the UN and an effort to have some kind of international engagement in this is a good thing.
Aram Nurgusian, Senior Fellow and Middle East Expert with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. As the security situation in Egypt continues to deteriorate, a growing number of citizens are taking the law into their own hands. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has details from Cairo.
In some neighborhoods across Cairo and the country, neighbors make up for the lack of police protection by banding into watch groups. In others, Islamist leaders have made inroads, calling for informal militias to provide security when needed. Tarek Badir of the conservative organization Gamaa Islamia put together an informal militia during a recent police strike. Badir explains that his group would step in to protect lives and the belongings of both the people and the state if the police didn't go back and do their jobs. His group, now part of the political fabric of post-revolution Egypt, is considered a terrorist group by the United States. Such informal security patrols are the alternative to Egypt's long-reviled police force, which largely disappeared after the 2011 revolution. Many of the police who eventually came back complained they're ill-treated, poorly paid and underarmed, and thrust far too much into the nation's political upheaval. Once again, many have walked off the job. Egypt's top prosecutor, Talat Abdullah, this week urged ordinary Egyptians to step in to fill the void. Police officer Islam Mabrouk thinks that's a terrible idea. He says the prosecutor general was wrong when he gave civilians the right to arrest each other because it turned everyone into a policeman. Now anyone, Mabrouk says, can arrest people on the streets. Or worse, a mob lynching of two suspects in a Nile Delta town prompted Justice Minister Ahmed Mekki to say it was a sign of the death of the state. Heba Marayef of Human Rights Watch in Cairo is also alarmed by the trend of civilians taking the lead in security.
This new license that's been given to private citizens to become involved in violence is an even more dangerous one, because you see a weakening of the role of the state, and this honestly this opens the door to vigilantism moving forward, and that's not a healthy environment in which to protect rights ultimately.
While some Egyptians have called for the military to intervene, Marayef says it's better to focus on reforming the police into a responsible force.
Nothing's happened yet, but at least, you know, you're dealing with a police force and there can be top-down decisions to eventually, over the next decade, change police behavior.
But with Egypt's political scene in a stalemate, a decision to even start that process seems a long way off. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
The violence continues in Mali. France says about 10 Islamist fighters were killed Thursday as French and Malian forces repelled an attack on the northern Mali city of Timbuktu. The clash followed a suicide bombing at a Malian army checkpoint near the Timbuktu airport late Wednesday. The bomber and one Malian soldier were killed. It was the first suicide attack in Timbuktu since a French-led offensive drove Islamist militants out of their northern Mali strongholds in January. Vicki Huddleston is the former U.S. ambassador to Mali. VOA's Carol Castiel asked her why it is in the U.S. national interest to assertively help save Mali from further chaos.
Quite simply, can we, can Africa, can the West have a jihadist terrorist state in the center of Africa? Are we willing to have a foreign occupier with a foreign religious ideology take over Mali and 12 million people? I can't imagine this. And that too would spread. Niger is not a strong government, nor is Mauritania, or Cameroon, or Nigeria. We cannot allow terrorists and crime to take over Africa. And the Africans themselves, that's the most important thing. They don't want Al-Qaeda to take over their countries.
What do you think the role of the United States should be?
I think the United States needs to do quite a lot. First of all, the United States has a big responsibility. The United States has a responsibility because we led the coalition in Libya. What set the fire, the match that set the fire, was Libya. That's where the Tuareg troops came from, and that's where immense amounts of sophisticated weapons and vehicles came from. But secondly, we did not effectively help the region to form an effective military strategy. So with no regional military strategy, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb and its breakaway movement for unity and jihad in West Africa grew and prospered when this war could have been prevented.
With respect to Algeria, to what extent do you think they will play a role in potential UN stabilization force that's being talked about for Mali? To what extent are they ready to basically take up the role that you are advocating because of their knowledge of the problem, the Islamist threat, the intelligence networks that they have, and so forth?
Well, clearly they're showing some hesitancy, but there are three things that has to be done. You have to defeat the Al-Qaeda and you have to secure the area. Secondly, you have to address the grievances of the nomadic population in the north, perhaps some form of autonomy. And third, you have to repair and mend the Malian government. Algeria is absolutely essential to all three, and I do not believe that Algeria can ignore its southern border.
Vicki Huddleston, former U.S. ambassador to Mali. To hear more of her conversation with VOA's Carol Castiel, tune in Saturday and Sunday for Press Conference USA. the global population grows, so does the need for water. The World Watch Institute says increased demands for food, energy, and industry, along with climate change, could lead to water scarcity in some places. The warning comes on World Water Day. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
World Watch says billions of people are already facing some kind of water scarcity or shortage. Spokesperson Supriya Kumar says it's only expected to get worse as the population increases.
Over 1.2 billion are basically living in areas of physical water scarcity, and almost 1.6 billion face economic water shortage. And these are really extreme numbers, and as our population continues to grow, there's just going to be more problems, and we're going to really have to face drastic measures in order to make sure that people have access to water.
Kumar says there are several types of water scarcity. The first is called physical.
Physical water scarcity really just means that there's not enough actual water to meet all demands. Water is not distributed evenly. You know, areas in the Middle East, in northern China, in northwestern India, very arid regions where there's just not enough water. And so there's just not physical availability.
And then there's economic water scarcity.
Physical water scarcity really just means that there's not enough actual water to meet all demands. Water is not distributed evenly. You know, areas in the Middle East, in northern China, in northwestern India, very arid regions where there's just not enough water. And so there's just not physical availability.
Kumar says action to relieve these problems can be taken on the local, national, and regional levels.
In terms of the local level, we could put more investment into water harvesting, into better methods of reusing water that's wasted, treating it to be reused for agriculture or for other industries.
On the national level, the World Watch Institute recommends that governments develop better water policies, which could include fewer or revised agricultural subsidies.
For example, in India, a lot of farmers have subsidies that provide them with the use of electricity for 24 hours without any fees. And so that leads them to pump water constantly, which is really depleting the groundwater.
World Watch says globally, 70% of what's called water withdrawals is for agriculture, 19% for industry, and 11% for municipal demands. Some of the countries with very high withdrawals include India, China, and the United States. Many water sources are not confined within a particular country's borders. Rivers and lakes are often used by several nations, and therefore regional agreements would be needed on water use. Climate change, with its rising global temperatures, has a direct effect on water scarcity, says Kumar, especially when it comes to rainfall.
The changes in the rainfall patterns seriously affect some of the sectors, especially agriculture. For example, in India, a lot of farmers are unable to prepare for what crops they're going to grow because they're just not sure if the amount of rainfall they're going to receive and when they're going to receive that rainfall. And that's a large effect that climate change is having.
Kumar says uncertainty about rainfall can directly affect food security. What's more, the World Watch Institute expects that in the Mediterranean basin and the semi-arid areas of the Americas, Australia, and Southern Africa, there will be reductions in river runoff. It also expects aquifers, underground water-saturated rock, to take much longer to recharge. In Asia, large areas of irrigated land could be adversely affected by changes in water runoff patterns. Also, highly populated delta regions could be affected by reduced freshwater runoff, rising sea levels, and greater salinity. The World Watch Institute's concerns about water scarcity can be found in its online Vital Signs reports. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.